said, is that right? Well, what I said still goes. Get out of here. Game hasn't even started.
The late Fred Hutchinson, too, as a manager one time, I heard this story about him. He came out, and he never used swear words, but he got his message across, and apparently he went up to the umpire as he was challenging him and didn't win the battle and walked away and came back and just turned around and said, by the way, I stopped by the dog pound, and your mother's fine.
Oh, you hear some great lines. You know, DeRocher very rarely used bad language, but he used a lot of words that began with S. Like you said, it was a strike. I didn't strike, and that's a very juicy word, S. And after about a minute and a half of that, Lou Jordan was there, and I mean, he almost needed windshield wipers. And Jordan says to Leo, you spitting on me? Who's spitting on you? And boom, I mean, those guys are, but umpires, I got to tell you, boy, they'll win most of them.
Yeah. Also, I'm interested in the relationship of the catcher to the umpire because they really do know how to work with them or work them in a sense. Give us some insight about how that relationship develops during the course of one's career, one's game, and just how you work an umpire.
Well, you know the guys who have a sense of humor. You know guys that got a personality like an oak tree, so you leave them alone. And you learn their strike zone in a hurry, and you learn you don't gripe that much. I mean, the best example I can give you is I had it happen to me a number of times. You know, you'd say, that was a strike. No, Joe, it wasn't a strike now. And it was it wasn't a strike. Okay, so now the inning's over. You come up and hit. And the same pitch that he called a ball now comes to you, and he calls it a strike. And I back out of the box, and I say, how come on him it's a ball, on me it's a strike? And very politely they'll say, Joe, you're a nice guy. And, you know, I thought about what you said. That pitch is a strike, and I'm going to call it a strike. So now he's got you both ways. Gives the opponent the ball call, and he gives me the strike call, but very diplomatic.
One of the things that you say in the book, the first thing a catcher does is take census. Explain that.
Well, you got to see who's out there because a lot of times you don't have eight guys in front of you. Del Wilbur told me about Lou Novikov, the mad Russian, came up with the Cubs. They're playing in Houston and in the minor leagues. And bottom of the ninth, they look out, there's no left fielder. So they hold up the game, send the clubhouse boy or the bat boy into the clubhouse, see if he's in there. He comes back. He said, no, I didn't see him. And so they put another guy out there, game's over. Houston wins. They go in the clubhouse. Who's there at the door to greet him but Novikov? Wilbur said, where were you? He said, when you got to go, you got to go.
The other thing that I think is really important for the catcher, and the good ones are able to do this, and I know in talking to Johnny Bench about this, I asked him, I said, what was the difference between the way you handled a young pitcher when you had to go out to the mound as compared to the veteran? I just wonder your thoughts on that, the catcher and how they work pitchers.
Ron, the best story I can tell you about that, the great Bill Dickey told me. He was catching this kid just out of college at the Yankees, and the kid crossed him up twice. Bill walked out to the mound, and he said, you know, I can't get on this kid because he'll just, you know, he'll crumble. So he said to him, son, playing in the big leagues is just like pitching in college. Except for one thing, the catchers up here are really dumb. They have to know what's coming. I mean, come on. Usually you go out there and you go out there to break a mood, and you're liable to hear anything from pitchers. I mean, they get in the jam and they'll get to inventing pitchers. Like, I had a pitcher shook me around twice, went out to the mound. I said, what do you want to do? He said, I'll throw him a slider. I said, a slider? You don't have a slider. He said, that's why I'm going to get him out. He won't be looking for it. This is a guy who's going to get a batter out with a pitch he didn't have.
I mentioned about you starting your pro career at the age of 16. You would not hear of that today. How did it all come about, Joe?
Well, in those days, you could sign a player. I was a sophomore in high school. Now you got to do your class and draft and all that kind of thing. But Mr. Ricky, he was great for signing as many ball players who had what he thought was talent, and he didn't miss on too many of them. And so he signed you. You played in Class C or Class D and worked your way up. I got a chapter on Mr. Ricky and Giamatti. Mr. Ricky is one of my heroes because, Ron, he scouted everything. I'm watching the game with him. I'm not going to go into it. would take a while, but it's really worthwhile how he saw Jackie Robinson start to take a lead, and he literally diagrammed how, if he got us to a certain point, he would steal home. And he got to that point, and he said, he's there, he's not afraid to fail, he will go, and he will make it. And by golly, he did. I was stunned. But he did things like, we're watching the game one day, and I used to, whenever I'd get to Pittsburgh, I'd always see, if he was going to be at the park, which he usually was, unless he was out making a speech. One of the runners had a lead. He said, I'll bet he wears suspenders. What? He said, I'll bet he wears suspenders. I said, Mr. Rickey, what's that got to do with him taking a lead? He said he's afraid to fail. He thinks he's going to get picked off. He's only off a step and a half, and I'll guarantee you, he'll put a belt on and say, oh, my pants are going to fall. I better put his suspenders on, too. Going to the dentist, how about this? He said that when he went to the dentist, he checked the magazines. If the magazines were old, he said, then I would say to myself, this doctor is not keeping up with today's technology. But if he had new magazines, I knew he was keeping up to date. I mean, he scouted everything.
What was it that made him before his time? Because I've talked to other people about him, and there's a recent book out about Branch Rickey. But he always seemed to be ahead of his time about the way he cared about ball players, about forming teams, scouting talent, as you indicated.
People talk about a sixth sense and all that, but he worked at it, and he wasn't afraid to try things. I mean, I've seen him come by, and he had a sense of humor. He really did. He'd come by with a wild pitcher warming up, and he'd take off that hat, and it was one of those fedoras, and he'd put it on the ground, and he'd say to the kid pitcher, stand right here, be about 3 feet from the hat. Hit that hat. The kid would throw it in the hat, it'd go spinning, and then he'd back the kid up, and that hat would be just taking a tremendous beating. And then he'd get him back to about 60 feet 6 inches, which is the distance between mound and home plate, and that kid would still be throwing at that hat and hitting it, and Mr. Rickey would pick up that dirty old hat, knock it against his knees, and say, it's confidence, my boy. It's confidence. You have the ability. It's confidence. He just had simple ways of doing things, and he convinced you that that was the way to do it. I was blocking pitches one day with John Fitzpatrick, and they're bouncing them off my chest and everything, and Mr. Rickey walked by. He said, how's he doing? Fitz said, good, I got a new glove for him. Great trade.
The other thing that I know about baseball, and I know that all athletes tend to be a little bit superstitious, but I have never seen it like I see it in baseball. What were some of the great superstitions and some of the things that players did to try to get out of slumps? Because you have a beautiful chapter here called Hitting Slumps and Red Peppers.
Yeah, I got those wild chapter headings. Well, Richie Ashburn, when he was going good, he'd take his bat to bed with him. Red Shandings would he'd draw eyes on it so he could get some seeing hits with it. And if he didn't get it with the eyes on it, he'd drop murine on the part where he put the eyes. That was another thing he would do. Guys, I'm telling you, they just believed that they had to do some of that mojo to get it done. But Yogi always believed there's just so many hits in the bat. And he would never tell me how many. I said, how do you know how many? I never use it in batting practice, I'll tell you that. but today, I mean, these guys, not only are they superstitious, but, I mean, they're very religious. As soon as they hit the ball, they go right to the heavens. And they're pointing up there, and which reminds me of when Pearsall made a sign of the cross by home plate. Yogi was catching, and he got out of his crouch and went over there and rubbed it out and said, why don't you let God just watch the game?
Also, one of the things that I love about this book, Joe, is the fact that you have in here, and I think it'll give fans a great insight to scouting reports. You got one here for Pedro Martinez, and you've got some other scouting reports on teams and everything. I was reading through those, and it's just amazing how much they break down the game. Was it always a science to some degree, or was it more feel when you were playing?
I tell you what, you got the book in front of you. look at those early reports, like the one before Alan Roth, where he's got the diagrams. Every scouting report that I have in there is an official scouting report that I got from the team that was in the World Series. For example, the Cardinal one, when they had McGee and Ozzie Smith and Vince Coleman and all those Jackrabbits and Whitey Herzog guys, read that scouting report, and that'll answer your question, because I think it's one of the funniest ones going, but it tells you everything you want to know about it.
Well, in the one, the Cardinal one that's in your book, it says, this is a running ball club, and they'll steal your ass off. They'll steal when they're ahead. They'll steal when they're behind. They'll just steal.
That's right. I mean, now, but today, you look at the report, they'll say his move to first base is 1.6. He's 2.7 going to second base on a fastball. On a night game, he's 2.4. Come on. It's like that report said, this team will steal your ass off if you go to sleep.
The other thing, too, that I've noted, and I had a conversation with someone recently in the National Football League about the fact that the NFL tends to be in love with the 40 time. In other words, is it 4.2 and what have you? Do you think the statistics come into play way too much and not the character and the heart of the player today?
Well, I think so. I mean, to me, and I go back to Mr. Rickey, you could never argue statistics with him because it was your place in the lineup. I think on-base percentage is very important. Ron, they gave me a statistic 2 years ago. As I say, I told you before, I do some of the Diamondback games. I had to laugh out loud. Carlos Quentin, Q-U-E-N-T-I-N, hit a home run off Chad Qualls, Q-U-A-L-S. And they handed me a statistic. It was the first time in the history of the game that a batter whose last name began with a Q hit a home run off a pitcher whose last name started with a Q. Now, does that help you win a game? I don't think so. How about the statistic they gave me? Most successful steals after pickoff attempts. What does that tell you? You know, it's like saying, go to church, you'll find some holy water there.
You also talk about ballparks in here, and I've always felt that they were somewhat like cathedrals. Yes, there was a period of time when they became cookie cutter. Now we're getting back to personality ballparks. Your favorite memories over the years as both a broadcaster and a player of ballparks?
Well, the best ballpark for me to broadcast was that old brick stadium, because you were right on top of home plate. In fact, you had to broadcast the game if you kept the window open with the glove on, because those foul balls came back right at you. But you were right on top of the batter, the umpire, and the catcher, and you could talk to the umpire between innings. I liked that. And I liked the Forbes Field because it was a big ballpark. It was a triple and doubles ballpark, and I think the most exciting play in baseball is the steal of home or the inside-the-park home run. Today, I mean, you go to ballpark, and I know they need streams of revenue because you got to pay such big money and everything is sold. But, I mean, it used to be between innings you could talk a little baseball. Now here you got to root for who's going to win the race, relish, ketchup, or mustard, the all-tell direct call to the bullpen, the Jiffy Lube this and that. It's just everything is commercial, and the seats are expensive, man, I'm telling you.
Over the years, when you think about the great hitters over the decades, what is the commonality of all of them? Because Rod Carew one time told me that he could pick up the rotation of the ball out of the pitcher's hand. Now, I don't know whether that was fact or fiction, but knowing how well Rod Carew hit it probably was fact. But what do you find is the commonality of all the great hitters, Joe?
Focus. They could focus, and they had a system. Ted Williams always, when he preached hitting, and I sat with him a lot in spring training, and then after he was out of the game, he said, if you're up there hitting and that pitcher throws that good fastball on the outside part of the plate for a strike, take it. You take that pitch until you got two strikes on you. And then you got two strikes on you, choke up on that bat, put the ball in play. But try to get your pitch. But don't think that the pitcher doesn't know what your the pitch you're looking for, and he's not going to try to give it to you, but they do make mistakes.
Joe Garagiola, a man always with a baseball story ready to share with you. Finally, in my broadcasting career, I've interviewed thousands of athletes. Brian Stann is a person and an athlete I'll never forget. He's not only a mixed martial arts fighter, but also a man who fought for his country in two tours in Iraq and he won the Silver Star for valor in combat. He's a hero. Having broadcast Sports Byline USA from Iraq and Afghanistan 6 times, he and I connected as we talked about the war, the violence, and the realities of combat. In his book, Heart of the Fight, A Marine Hero's Journey from the Battlefields of Iraq to Mixed Martial Arts Champion, Stan shared his thoughts, feelings, and insights in being both a combat soldier and a mixed martial arts combatant. I started by asking him to reflect on the path and journey of his life, and what is it that amazes Brian Stan the most?
I'd say the people that I've met along the way. You know, at every facet of my life, I've met some amazing, amazing people, both men that I've led and both leaders that I've encountered. And I think that, you become shaped by those people. And they've all truly helped me become the man that I am today. And they've given me the direction towards the man that I hope to be someday. And so I think it's really the people that I run into that have really been the number one thing that stands out for me.
One of the things I also know is that we're all shaped by our past and the environment in which we grew up in, and you grew up in South Scranton, Pennsylvania. I'm going to quote from the book here. You say, "Fear and I became acquainted very early in my life. As a kid, I went to South Scranton Intermediate School, a graffiti-scarred hellhole built sometime around the Second World War with barred windows and brown paint that gave the place a jailhouse sort of vibe. The gangs roaming the hallways seemed like the natural order of things. In those halls, you joined a gang for self-protection, became a perpetual victim, or tried to steer a path between the two. I chose the latter mainly because I didn't want to lose my individuality. I had to fight to hold on to it." Talk a little bit more about Scranton, Pennsylvania, and Brian Stan.
Well, Scranton was recently ranked the 4th fastest dying city in America, just behind Flint, Michigan. So I think that kind of gives you an idea, of what it was like. And, it's an old coal mining city. And when coal ceased to be a commodity, the city ceased to be fortuitous and prospering. And so, what you have there is you just have a lot of blue-collar people who have to work hard for every dime they have. And in particular, South Scranton Intermediate School just happens to sit in between a number of projects. And, me being the person that I am, and I've always been this way, there's not a lot of gray area with me. People either really like me or they really hate me. And that's just always the way it's been. And sometimes they determine this the minute they see me before they even know me. And so, when you go to a school like that and you have gangs and such that way, I've always been a confident guy, liked to voice my opinion, would speak up in class, cared about my schoolwork, and enjoyed, being an athlete. And for that reason, I drew the attention of some of these gangs and kids that were older than me that just were looking for, something bad to get into and something to pick on. And, there were just many times, just about every day I had to worry about, okay, who's going to be waiting for me after school? Which way am I going to walk home? And that was just kind of the regular occurrence for things for me and my friends in 6th and 7th grade, until I was in 8th grade and finally we were the oldest guys in the school.
You say, being an individual in a world of conformity and violence made me a target. I grew up fast and I learned how to use my fists when I needed them. Did you ever have that crossroads where you could have gone one way or the other?
I did. And I think it really was, it was in 8th grade, where I had a circle of friends that really started down the path. I mean, as early as, really 6th or 7th grade, but even more so in 8th grade where, drugs started becoming an everyday thing, alcohol, sex. I mean, we had a couple girls in the school that, literally had to cease their education because they got pregnant. And one of my circle of friends actually went down that path, and I had to make the choice. And at the end of that year, my mother decided I was going to go to a different high school. I wasn't going to go to Scranton High School, that I was going to go to Scranton Prep. And, she was a hardworking woman, and, luckily for us, she sent me to a football camp before 8th grade that was run by the Scranton Prep coaches. So the football coaches knew who I was. They wanted me on their team, and they'd been calling me my entire year in 8th grade to make sure I took the entrance exams, and they also helped facilitate my financial aid applications, which was great. And the coach told me he'd be able to get me a job in the summer to help towards tuition, and that's how me and my family did it. And I did not want to go to that school at all. I wanted to stay with my friends. you know, but a lot of times, like we are at that age, we think we know everything. We don't want to listen to our parents. And I look back at my life, and that was certainly a crossroads. You know, my mom pulled me out of that environment, put me in a completely different school. We moved out of the city and moved into the country, and it changed a lot of things. And luckily for me, I like to hope that I would have ended up on the right side of the tracks regardless, but certainly that was a big change for me and certainly helped facilitate me going to the Naval Academy.
What triggered the thought and the belief that you wanted to go to the Naval Academy?
It was by my junior year in high school that I really knew that that was for me. I could tell immediately, and even amongst my peers in high school, and I had been criticized for this since I can remember, maybe being 7 or 8 years old, but everybody would always say to me, gosh, you take things too seriously. You take things too seriously. And, you know, I hear it even to this day. And I knew had I gone to a regular school that I probably wouldn't have a lot of friends or may not get along with a lot of people. You know, my high school football team, I was a team captain, and I was really committed to winning. And we made a commitment that we weren't going to drink during the season. We weren't going to do this. We weren't going to do that. You know, people were violating that left and right. I took it very serious, and people didn't appreciate that. So I knew with my type of personality that I would probably be best suited to go to a military academy, and that may be the right environment for me. And once I got to the Naval Academy, I was even a little serious for some of the people that were there. And I eventually found the environment where being overly serious is a welcome, you know, even to the extremity, you know, to the extreme, and that's the United States Marine Corps. So that's kind of how I wound up there.
Playing middle linebacker for the Naval Academy, was that your way to get aggression out?
Oh, absolutely. You know, and it was for all of us, you know, especially when you're going to the Naval Academy and, you know, you're dealing with some of the things that we dealt with, which were some really tough football seasons. I was there during a transitional period between coaches, et cetera. And, you know, football was certainly our release, without a doubt. You know, especially when you're confined to that environment while all your peers from high school are out having fun.
When you take a look back at your experience at the Naval Academy, what is it that you got out of it more than anything else, Brian?
Lifelong friends. I couldn't say only that. I would say that's the first thing that comes to mind is I made some friends that no matter how long, we could go 5 years without speaking to each other. And if we ran into each other anywhere at a football game, at an alumni event, we would pick up right where we left off. And, you know, second to that is an amazing education. There was nothing about the curriculum there that was disappointing. I had to study harder than I'll ever have to study in my life to get good grades at that school. It was a very, very challenging curriculum, and the friends that I made there will last a lifetime, and I wouldn't give them up for anything in the world.
How did you approach going to Iraq? You know, you went over, you were a lieutenant. What were your thoughts about going into that conflict?
I couldn't wait. I was young, dumb, naive, you know, just like a lot of the soldiers and Marines that are getting ready to go on the front lines that are in the infantry or combat arms MOS. And, you know, everybody wants to see the pink elephant, I always say, and the pink elephant being combat. You know, they want to get shot at. They want to have their war stories. You know, they want to be known forever as a warrior, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, what ends up happening is when you do get into that environment and you do face those adversities, things happen to people that you care an awful lot about. And you get memories and you make decisions and you're burdened with things that you'll be burdened with the rest of your life that, you know, I would give up everything I have other than my wife and children right now. Anything I've received from those wars, this book, medals, whatever, to have my Marines back, I'd give it all up. And, you know, that's kind of how I felt going in. I was a young, aggressive lieutenant, could not wait to get my platoon, couldn't wait to get into the fight. I already had buddies of mine from the school that were already over there. I had lost friends in Iraq already, and I felt like I was sitting on the sidelines because I wasn't over there yet.
One of the things that I know from having spent six tours over there, broadcasting from over there, Brian, is there is a perception and there is a reality. You have certainly lived that reality. Can you put it into words for me and the listeners?
You know, I'll certainly do my best. You know, the reality of it is it's not something that's so cool to have been in combat. The reality is to be a veteran who's truly seen combat normally comes with very, very violent and sudden loss of life to people that you care an awful lot about, memories that you'll never forget. And as an officer, it's normally your decisions that led your men ultimately to their death. and you're going to nitpick at those decisions. You're going to nitpick at the planning, the courses of action, everything you did for the rest of your life, because when that deployment's over, you're going to have to look that Marine or soldier's mother right in the eyes, and you're going to have to tell her why you couldn't bring them home. And, you know, that's the reality that we live with. You know, so when people watch movies like Rambo or any of these new ones that are out there, and they think it's just so cool to be a scarred warrior, you know, it certainly comes with its price. And normally when you see a guy who beats his chest saying, hey, I'm a warrior, a lot of times they may be fabricating a lot of their stories.
Let me go back and talk and use an analogy of football and also combat for just a second, because your words were very telling in the last segment. They always talk about the first step being so important in football, whether you're a running back, you're a linebacker, that first step to the action. The same way, when you're in combat, that first decision that you have to make, the important decision, because I, as a pilot, learned that if you second-guess your decision, then you're going to get yourself in a yo-yo situation. Did you find it the same way, Brian?
Absolutely. And you know, sometimes the most important part of that first decision is just making it in a timely fashion. You know, there's going to be, in any situation in combat, there's going to be a number of decisions you can make. Some of them will be right, some of them will be wrong. But if you make it quick enough so that your men can react to it and you give them a task and purpose so that they can operate knowing exactly what you want them to do, and they can go 100 miles an hour doing it, sometimes that will overcome, you know, even if it'll overcome the adversity if the decision was wrong. And, you know, it's being decisive out there. You can't take 5 or 10 minutes to look at the map and say, hey, turn this way, don't turn that way, or, you know, blow through. And, I mean, when you're trapped in the kill zone or something happens, you need to make that decision, you need to make it fast. And that, at least, if you're clear and concise in the orders you give your men on that decision, then they can operate, you know, at 100 miles an hour, and they'll make up for any mistakes you may make, because, you know, the Marines and soldiers that are over there are the best trained force that this world's ever seen.
Tell me a little bit about being devoid of emotion when you make a decision.
You know, it's the strangest feeling, but it is, it's just the way you are when you're out there. You absolutely are. There's no emotion whatsoever. You're just a complete constantly calculating force that's on the battlefield. And, you know, you're just wielding your decisions to move your men into the right place, ultimately to, you know, to accomplish the mission. And it's very difficult to define in words what that's like to be an officer or decision maker in combat and have no emotion running through you during sometimes some of the most emotional events you could possibly go through. I think it's part of the training we go through that our nation's military has created, and part of the mindset that you develop when you go to a school like the Naval Academy and then ultimately join the Marine Corps.
Tell me about that six-day period starting on May 8th, 2005 in Iraq.
Well, you know, it was a true test of my endurance. But similar to being a parent, you know, when you're a platoon commander, you know, you basically inherit 40 or so, you know, children, regardless of their age. I mean, they are yours, they are your responsibility, they are your pride, they're everything to you. And so regardless of how tired you are, I mean, you do not have the time to think about how you feel or how you feel about what just happened, or are you scared, are you hungry, are you tired? I mean, those things don't even come to mind. You're so concerned with your men and the mission at hand that those days go by rather quickly. And that you really don't even, I mean, you could be starving, you could be sleep deprived, whatever. A lot of times you're not going to realize it because you're constantly checking on your guys. You're constantly worried about, okay, what's next? Okay, based on my position right now and my situation, what's the enemy going to try to do to me next? What do I have to do to be one step ahead of him and counter that so I don't lose any men? And, you know, when you're constantly thinking like that, you know, you're just not thinking about yourself. And two, you know, you're doing all the right things for your guys. That's exactly what you're supposed to be doing. If you start thinking internally, then that's when problems start happening. And you're not prepared, and you get ambushed, or you get attacked, and you and your men aren't ready, and you lose lives.
And what type of combat did you have to endure during that six-day period, Brian?
You know, during that, you know, once we finally got to the bridge, things simplified a little bit in that, you know, we had some distance between us and the enemy. and it wasn't in the confined spaces of a very urban, dense area where it's really hard to identify, you know, where the enemy is. It's difficult to wield some of your biggest weapon systems because you're kind of, you know, you're danger close with tank main gun rounds and et cetera, and for, you know, using close air support. But, you know, when we got to the six-day period, at least we had a little bit of a buffer. You know, we had anywhere from, 200 to 800 meters between us and the enemy. The problem was, though, is still we were getting attacked from two, sometimes three different areas and directions. And it became very difficult, you know, when snipers start shooting at you, where is this guy? So, I mean, you can't even get out of your vehicle to take a piss because you're getting shot at, and you have no idea where this guy's shooting at you from. It's very, very frustrating, and it takes a very large mental toll on your men when they're caught in that situation, and they're afraid, you know, to even say that they have to go to the bathroom. As the days went on, the mortar fire got a little bit more accurate because we had to stay at the bridge. I mean, that was the key terrain, so there's not a whole lot of options on where you can move your vehicles, and you can only move them so far and keep them dispersed as much as possible, but eventually they're going to dial in pretty close to their mortars. So those were really the challenges during the six-day conflict. It was really at the end, you know, where I had to decide, okay, how are we going to get back to the base? What's the decision point going to be? And, you know, my regiment wanted me to drive back the same way I came through and lost a vehicle and lost a tank. And I ultimately had to tell them, absolutely not. I'm not going to go that direction. It makes absolutely no sense. The mission's complete. Why would I risk losing any more men on the ride back home? And that was a bit of an argument, and it made more sense for me to head west, northwest, to a combat outpost we had, stay there, refuel for a couple hours, and then drive in the open desert where the threat was minimal. To get back home, it was a long way home, but a lot of times, as you know from going to Iraq and Afghanistan, the path less traveled is usually the least dangerous path.
You know what I find interesting about that statement, Brian, is it goes back to your childhood where you said about individuality and how you had to fight for it, because the chain of command is so important in the military that you would stand up to the chain of command for what you thought was best for your men. When you think back on that, were you surprised that you did that in that moment?
No, you know, because I'm still that way today. and every once in a while it gets me in trouble, and every once in a while it's it's the right decision. But at that point in time in my life, I knew it was the right decision. And, you know, I had thought about it enough to know that there was nothing, even if I drove the way we came through, I encountered some bad guys, we killed some bad guys, but I lost another Marine, or I got another Marine permanently injured. What would be the value? I mean, the mission is over at this point. Yes, we killed some bad guys, but as we know, in that situation, you know, on that same day, three more insurgents just turned 16 and picked up an AK. So, you know, really, what would the long-term value of that be? And now I lost a Marine, and that just was not worth it to me. It made more sense. The mission was complete. The mission was successful. Let's egress the long way home so I have much better chance of getting all my guys back and get ready for the next mission.
And how many men did you have, and how many men did you return with?
I had 42, and I came back with 42, luckily.
He was awarded the Silver Star for Valor in Combat, the third highest award that you can get. And Brian said after receiving the award, "This award represents my guys. It's an insight to what my men did over there. There were a lot of our guys who received awards from our group when we were out there. Not just me. You can forget all the other medals. I just wanted the award that said 42 out of 42 men came home safely. And we all came home, so mission accomplished." When you looked into the eyes of your soldiers, and you know, I know that men being men and Marines being Marines, did you have a sense of satisfaction that they had appreciated what you had done?
You know, it wasn't, I don't know if it was immediate, to be honest with you. You know, when we pulled in, the first thing I wanted to do was I wanted to check on a few of my Marines that had gotten wounded, and that we had to evacuate medically, specifically one named Robert Gass, who took a huge piece of shrapnel to his head. So immediately I think everybody was really concerned with him and getting the latest update and making sure he was alive and he was okay and he was going to make it. But certainly, you know, though, I remember flying home. During our flight home, we stopped at some air base in Italy, And it turns out that it was part of a major airport, and they had a bar in there. And, you know, so of course everybody that was on the plane from my company went into that bar. We had about 2 hours, and everybody drank as much as they possibly could. But at that point in time, you know, right as soon as we got in there, all of my men kind of gathered around, and that's exactly when I got that look. And they were very satisfied, and they said some of the things that I'll always cherish the most. And I'm lucky in the fact that, you know, every once in a while I still hear from them today. And things like Facebook are great for those situations.
I want to touch on one other thing about your experience in the military and also in Iraq. You came back from Iraq. You had a second tour over there, and you came back. And I have found in the soldiers that I have known on my trips over to Iraq and Afghanistan that I have met, they tend to go one of two different ways, Brian. Because of what they have seen, what they have witnessed, what they've been involved in, they either become pacifist in some ways, they want the path of least resistance, they don't want to have confrontation, or they're adrenaline junkies. What path did you end up taking? And I think I know the answer to that, but why did you take the path?
I certainly wasn't a passive guy. I don't know if I was an adrenaline junkie, but I really don't have, I guess if you look at my life right now, I don't have a lot of evidence to support that theory. But my second deployment was tougher than my first, and it required a level of leadership to inspire my men through some very, very difficult times. And that level of leadership was very, very demanding. And we averaged losing, you know, my battalion averaged losing two Marines or one and a half Marines every 15 days. And that's just killed in action. That's not even counting wounded. So it was a tough, tough deployment. And I had to lead by example. You know, my men had to patrol all day, every day. And the same streets they patrolled were the same streets they were getting killed on, from IEDs, from snipers, from suicide vehicles. And I could not be the type of leader that sat in a command and control center and just kind of orchestrated the fight. I did that, but at the same time, every day, I went out on those streets with them. And I didn't just walk behind them, I walked in front of them. I took point. I went into buildings first. I inspected IEDs. And I had to take those risks, and, you know, my guys would develop all kinds of crazy stories about me and you know, thought I was indestructible, et cetera, and that's the point of doing things like that. They need to think that I have absolutely no fear, because when they see me think like that and feel like that, then they feel calmer, and when they're calmer, they make better decisions and they execute better. If they're scared, if they're frustrated, then obviously that slows down your decision making. It makes your decisions poor. It makes you sloppy, and I couldn't afford to have that. And so, I guess I can't say I was passive during that second tour, but I can tell you this: I was certainly not aggressive to the point where I put my men in danger when they didn't need to be.
Was there ever the fear of dying?
The fear of what?
Of dying.
No, honestly, at that point, I just didn't care.
And why didn't you care?
Well, you know, I had lost Marines pretty early, during that deployment, and it was just one of those things that even during my first deployment, I just came to terms with, and that was acceptable to me. Everybody has to die. We're all going to die someday, and that's a newsflash to some people, you know, that are young. They don't like to think about it, but, you know, I came to terms with that at a very young age and was very satisfied with the fact that if I were to die and die in battle, I'd be proud of that, and I was satisfied with it, so it was something that helped me get over the fear of it.
In your second tour in Iraq, you called a fight promoter, and you asked for a shot at the mixed martial arts world. Tell me a little bit about that. That sounded strange when I read that.
Well, you know, it was just one of those things where, I had done some fighting before my second tour, and I wanted to continue doing it. It was just a great hobby for me. It was something where, you know, I'm a warrior, and you know, I live in a martial culture that is the Marine Corps, and this is a warrior thing to do that I enjoy doing. And so it helped me cope with the reintegration back into the States when I came back from my first tour, so I wanted to do it my second tour, and it kind of helped me with the chip on my shoulder. You know, I didn't have much experience or much skill in fighting, and a lot of these promoters were ignoring me. And it kind of made me angry that I could walk around with a gun and fight in Iraq, but I couldn't fight in their cage or their ring for a couple $100. You know, give me a break. So I called them all up, and when they turned me down, I said, listen, I'm not going to say that I'm going to win the fight, but I guarantee I'm going to go in there and fight and be real entertaining. You know, and flat out told them, listen, if I could fight in Iraq, I could fight for you. You know, give me a shot. And they did. So, I mean, I fought, I think it was 6 weeks to the day that I landed for my second tour in Iraq.
I would also think, Brian, it was probably an outlet for you, because I've known a lot of soldiers that have come back from Iraq and Afghanistan, and all of a sudden they're taken out of a combat environment and put into a social environment, and it's very, very traumatic for them. And I would think you probably had to deal with that too, that acclimation back into society, and you were still connected to the military world in one sense, but you also were back in the civilian world in another sense, and so therefore the fighting was an ability to be able to try to get things to balance out. Am I correct in that observation?
Absolutely. You're absolutely right, and I've recommended it to so many Marines and soldiers, you know, about doing so. And that even if it's, you don't have to necessarily fight, there's grappling tournaments, there's all kinds of competitive things that you can get, that you can sign up for, that now you have something to look forward to and something that you're supposed to train for. And so in the time that you're not at work, where your mind can wander to dark places, you could get depressed or you could have issues with, you know, your reintegration back into society, you're now focused on something. And it's strenuous, it's physical. And when you work out, positive endorphins are released in your brain. And everybody knows that your confidence boosts when you're working out. You know, there's a huge character side to martial arts, and it absolutely was a very large release for me. And I think it's a huge part of who I am today, and why I haven't had any struggles in my personal life due to psychological scars from the war.
I'm very interested in the fact that when you were in Iraq, obviously the people that you were fighting and that you were involved in combat with were the enemy. But when you climb into the octagon and you're going up against a sports competitor, how do you look upon them? It can't be like they're the enemy. Do you look upon them just merely as a competitor that you need to defeat?
You know, it's changed. You know, it's not the same for every fight. But I do fight better when I look at them like they're the enemy. And that's just being brutally honest. It's probably not the most politically correct way of saying it, but it's still a fight, and I fight better when I'm angry. And my coaches know that, and they now realize that after, you know, so many fights, now that I've had 12 fights, and I absolutely fight better when I look at them like the enemy. And there's obviously certain things that I can look back on in my life and my past that will always motivate me to want to go out there on any given night. And put on a great performance. But the minute that fight is over, you know, they are simply just a competitor, and I give them the utmost respect.
You know, I believe that you probably have the upper hand in this sport because of the fact that you understood when you were in the military how to throw the switch on when you went into a combat environment, and so therefore it's the same way, because I think you know as well as I do, Brian, there have been a lot of athletes that if they're in a combative sport, say football, when they come off the field, they can't stop being combative. But you seem to be able to have understood that. Did the military experience help you deal to turn that switch on like you have to in ultimate fighting?
Absolutely. Absolutely they do. And, you know, infantry officer course in the Marine Corps specifically does an excellent job with that mindset. And when to turn it on, when to turn it off, et cetera. And it's been a huge, huge advantage for me in mixed martial arts, the mental aspect of it. You know, where I've certainly, up until now, you know, I've been on the lower end of the skill arena just because I've been training the sport less than the rest of the guys I'm fighting. But there's a lot of mental pressure in this sport, and it's a very mentally uncomfortable environment to walk in front of hundreds of thousands of people on national television and fight somebody with the risk of getting your butt kicked and getting embarrassed. And for a guy like me, you know, getting my butt kicked, you know, yeah, I don't really like it, blah, blah, blah. It's a tough experience. But in the big scheme of things, with what I've already been through and what I know men and women are going through in Iraq and Afghanistan, can I really complain if some guy breaks my nose on national television and I lost an athletic competition? No. You know, there's guys that lost their legs that same day. You know, so I put it in perspective. I go out there, I fight them and bring, you know, I give them hell for 15 straight minutes as hard as I can absolutely go. And if I, you know, if I win, I'm ecstatic. If I lose, I'm upset, but I'm not going to hang my head. Absolutely not. I owe the men and women who wear the uniform much more than that. I'm going to hold my head high. I'm going to go back to the gym. I'm going to fix my mistakes. I'm going to come back better the next time.
Brian Stann is a personification of the Marine Corps slogan, the few, the proud, the Marines. I hope you've enjoyed U.S. Airways' in-flight presentation of Sports Byline USA, and you'll listen to our live broadcast on radio, the American Forces Network worldwide, SiriusXM satellite radio, and the Internet. And if you'd like a listing of Sports Byline USA's radio affiliates, be sure to check our award-winning website. You'll find that at sportsbyline.com. I'm Ron Barr, and thanks for being a part of America's sports talk show, Sports Byline USA.